Well, we finished going through the book of Acts before, and I have another book that I want to go through here that will not take as long, because when we finish it, I have a number of individual topics that I'm going to get into, which I think will be ready by the time we finish. Anyhow, before we get into the book of Daniel, which is where I want to go today, I have a couple questions you sent to me, and let me begin by addressing them. The first one said, in Isaiah 44, verse 6 through 8, it says, I am the first and I am the last. That's right. And beside me there is no other God, it also says there. That's in Isaiah 44, and verses 6 through 8. In John 1, verse 1, it says that the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That's correct. We've covered that a lot of times. And third, in Romans 8, verse 29, it says, Jesus is firstborn among many brethren. And the question is, how can this be? It can be because you're probably misunderstanding or not seeing the context that each one is given in. Let's go back to Isaiah 44. Let me just turn over to Isaiah 44 quickly. Maybe I should do that. What is the purpose and what is Isaiah saying? And also, by the way, what is the word for God being used there? And I'll just tell you ahead of time to save time. It is Elohim, and which is, of course, a uniplural word. It's used in most cases in a singular sense. But going back to the sermons that I gave before Pentecost, that is in the time leading up to Pentecost, I covered the nature of God. And the question has always been, how is God one, and yet there are two separate members, the Father and the Son? So how is God one? And God is one through being a family. And if the people who came up, and by the way, we just put on our Life Open Truth website, I just noticed it last night, a good article on the Trinity. And you might want to go to that and read it. You have some time this afternoon. Very excellent article showing. I wonder how you do it, because it is a kind of a big subject, but they were able to put it and get it succinctly within a couple pages, under 2,000 words. It did a very good job, I thought, too, giving the history, the background, and how it came about, and that it was obviously not something that's taught in the Bible and never has been. But coming back here in Isaiah chapter 44, 6 through 8, it is showing that there's only one God, and but it doesn't say as an individual person. That's what people are mistaking in their minds. They think as an individual being, yet what is God? What is Elohim? And it can be more than one individual. It is a family. What is Smith? What is the family? Haefeli? Well, of course, just our immediate family, we're looking at five, because we have a daughter, we have two sons. Obviously, then they marry and have children, and it spreads and everything. And so, anyhow, in Isaiah, he is the one thing you want to keep in mind when you read, and there is none beside me. A lot of times it's been used in the past to try to say, see, you can't believe in two gods, Binitarianism, I believe, is the term that is used. Well, no, we're not saying two gods in the sense that two. It's a matter of understanding who and what God is. God is a family, and in a family there can be more than one member. You look at our country, the United States. Well, how many countries is that? It's plural, isn't it? Well, we know we, of course, have 50 states within the United States, but we're one country, just one country. Same with the word church, group, family, nation, singular but multiple memberships. Now, coming on, let me get to, let me see if I, because I'm a little unclear a little bit about the question at the end, how can this be? The reason it can be, as far as Jesus, who always existed in John 1:1, beside the Father, and the Word was God, was with God and was God, which we understand, and all things that were made, as it goes on in verse 3 of John 1, were created and made by the one who is the Word, or Jesus Christ. But he came here and he gave up, and there was a period of time he's existed for eternity with the Father. But there's a period of time he did not exist. It's like 3 days. 3 days. And then he was resurrected as he said he would. And now he is at the right-hand side of the Father. So in Romans 8:29, where Paul is speaking of that, actually it's talking about predestination in the first half of that verse. He is firstborn among many brethren. He is the firstborn of what? Of the resurrection to eternal life. Now, there have been people in the Old Testament, as well as during Christ's ministry, who were resurrected, but only to finish this physical life, not to eternal life. And so he is the first one among many brethren to come because he went through this as a sacrifice. He gave up his divinity, gave up everything. He was dead. And he was, because he had lived a, he was a perfect sacrifice, he had lived a perfect life. And yes, he was dead for 3 days and three nights, and then he was resurrected. So if there's been the difference between him and the Father is that he, for 3 days and three nights, did not exist. But he has existed for eternity. Now, that was set up that way. And, of course, you read in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 20 that it was foreordained before the foundation of the cosmos, which he created, to be the Lamb without blemish, referring back to the verse before it, verse 19. That's always mind-boggling when you think about it, because time means something to us in the flesh and as physical human beings. Time does not, the same way, it doesn't relate the same way to an eternal being in the spirit world. But it certainly does in this world to us. And it's hard to imagine how long it has been that God has been in the process of bringing many sons to glory through Jesus Christ. And that before the foundation of the cosmos, the universe created by Jesus Christ, he was foreordained to be that perfect sacrifice, knowing it needed to be done before it was even started. All right, let me move on to the next question. I hope I've answered this for you. The next one is, what is the significance of the Feast of Purim? Well, the significance, it's a Jewish national feast because of God's intervention and saving what would have been almost total extinction. One thing that's also very interesting about that, without spending a lot of time in the book of Esther, where it comes from, Purim, the I-M is plural, P-U-R is lots. The lot was cast, and it fell, of course, there in favor of the people. And so this feast is kept every year, as it says in the ninth chapter of the book of Esther. The ninth chapter of book of Esther between verses 20 and 26. That on the 14th and 15th day of Adar, 2 days in a row, there would be this national celebration and thanksgiving for God's deliverance of the Jewish people in the Persian Empire. Now you think a little bit about that, because if you go back to Genesis 49, Shiloh, as was prophesied, referring to the one who would be the Messiah to come, was to come through who? The tribe of Judah. And yet here's Satan working through this, I'll call him prime minister or whatever his title would have been at that time, under the king of Persia, wanted, and who was, we believe, was Xerxes the First or Xerxes the Great, and that he wanted to remove by annihilation all of the Jewish people throughout the 120 provinces of the Persian Empire. Well, everything, it's an interesting book, how that God worked changing things around, how the whole thing came back to where it turned on Haman instead. And what is the significance of it? It is not, the next question, does it equate with the last great day? No, it does not. It is simply separate. It is not a holy day. It is not a Sabbath day, unless it falls on the Sabbath, on the 14th and 15th of Adar is when they keep it. It possibly could. And that is February, maybe to the 1st of March, in that period of time on our calendar every year when that would fall, Adar being the 12th month. a 13-month year, you have 8R2. So anyhow, probably February most likely is when it's going to fall every year. I haven't followed it on the calendar, although in my Strong's Concordance copy, if you go to the back of it, you have all of the Jewish holidays listed there, the holy days, and also Purim, and I think Feast of Dedication as well, and as good references to see when they fall. Okay, let me move on to what I wanted to get into here and begin to start in the book of Daniel. I don't think I've ever done Daniel before here. The reason I think Daniel is a very important individual to take a look at, bring up one of my books I brought along. I want to read a few things. I'm going to take a little time and introduction before we actually go into the book of Daniel itself. I'm going to begin with a quote from a book entitled Daniel in the Critic's Den. And you'll see when I read here why I'm choosing to start this by, first of all, reading from this book. It's by an individual named Josh McDowell, and he's written a number of books. He probably, one of the best things he ever did was the one on going through all of the Old and New Testament. Evidence That Demands a Verdict is the title of that particular book, showing that indeed it is inspired, showing that it is not according to what the liberal critics have tried to say, that it was just something that had evolved. Now, the book of Daniel is one that's quite interesting that has been used by critics, and I'll just read a few things here and you'll see, and then I'll move on. Daniel has become a focal point of rationalist critics' attacks upon the Old Testament because it contains detailed, accurately fulfilled prophecies which demonstrate their divine inspiration. Well, right there you can see why to the critics who do not want to believe in God or miracles are immediately going to jump on that book and say that it was not written by Daniel in the 6th century B.C., it had to have been written after these things were fulfilled, you see, because that can't be, according to them. Now, such amazingly accurate predictions defy the possibility of merely human origin. If these prophecies were composed in the lifetime of the 6th century Daniel, they would compel our acceptance of special revelation from a transcendent personal God. No anti-supernaturalistic position can reasonably be defended if Daniel is a genuine book of prophecy composed in 530 BC or in the preceding years. That would have been at the end of his life, 530 BC. And of course, as you go through it, you'll see that Daniel's book goes right up to the fall of the Babylonian Empire. That's why 530 BC. Therefore, the rationalist scholar is compelled by his self-defense mechanism to seek for some way to avoid the evidential impact of Daniel. The only possible way to evade this testimony is to resort to a theory of spurious composition late enough in history to allow for prior fulfillment of all the predictions. And so that's why they want to claim it was in the 2nd century, around 165 B.C., at the time of the first abomination of desolation, that some unknown author wrote this book. After all, we know that anything that precise could not have been predicted before it happened, as you go through the book of Daniel. One other thing here, this other quotes here from a professor from a particular college, E.B., Puze, I think this is how you say his name, had an interesting quote I will share, and then I'll move on. The book of Daniel is especially fitted to be a battlefield between faith and unbelief. It admits no half measures. It is either divine or an imposter. To write any book under the name of another, that is another author, and to give it out to be his, is in any case a forgery, dishonest in itself and destructive of all trustworthiness. The writer, were he not Daniel, must have lied on a most frightful scale, ascribing to God prophecies which were never uttered, and miracles which are assumed never to have been wrought. In a word, the whole book would be one lie in the name of God. Well, very good analysis there. If that is true, you go to the major seminaries in this country where liberal theology is taught. You know, there's two different, what is liberal theology? Well, there is no God, and the Bible's not inspired. It's not his inspired word. And that's why I don't waste my time buying a comment. Some of you ask me, well, what commentary do you recommend? Well, I don't recommend anything of a liberal school, because I find out what their teachings are by going to the conservative commentaries. Not that they're perfect, but at least they recognize that God does exist, and that the Bible is not just something made up by unknown people in different generations of time. Okay, let me move on here a little bit about Daniel, because we're going to look at a few of the evidences and proofs that this liberal school really cannot deny, or they might deny it, but they certainly cannot answer it properly. Beginning in the 3rd century A.D., an unbeliever in the Greek world whose name was Porphyry, P-O-R-P-H-Y-R-Y, Porphyry, was the first individual to say that the book of Daniel was a forgery and that it was written in the period of the Maccabees, which is the same period of time when the abomination of desolation took place. Remember, it was the Maccabees who overthrew the Syrians, the Seleucids, and cleansed the temple. Well, then, after the 3rd century A.D., the book of Daniel was always accepted by Jewish and Christian scholars as a true historical document written in the 6th century B.C. But when modern criticism arose in the 19th century, they revived the theory of Porphyry in the name of modern scholarship. They stated it as a settled fact that Daniel was written in the 2nd century B.C. because they did not accept the detailed prophecies in the book as being written in the 6th century B.C. in Babylon before they were fulfilled. Now, 400 years, that's quite a period of time. Well, do they have a point? And if somebody began to throw some of these things at you, what would you say? What is the number one evidence and proof that the book of Daniel is authentic and was written in the 6th century? Where would you go in the Bible? There is a scripture that absolutely would be the number one. There's many proofs, by the way, but this one would be where I would begin, and I think you would too. Matthew 24, the Olivet Prophecy. Matthew 24, verse 15. What does Matthew 24, 15 say? I got my books here. I don't know if I can get to it, but it says, well, I better read it so I don't misquote it. But it has to do with, turn it over. Yes, I can do it here. Jesus said, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by, what's his name in the 2nd century? By Daniel the prophet. What does that say? Jesus said, Daniel the prophet, he recognized Daniel was a prophet and his book is authentic. By that statement, standing in the holy place and whoever reads, let him understand. That is where we would begin first of all. He mentions the abomination of desolation, which in that sense that he gives it is the one that is yet to come, which has not yet taken place. So we... The first evidence and proof, of course, we begin with Christ. The Son of God, who could not tell a lie, who lived a perfect life, a perfect sacrifice, would he have been deceived? Well, ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. He talks about the abomination of desolation, and he makes reference to it in the book of Daniel. I'll quickly just give you those scriptures. We're not going to cover them today. There are three places where the abomination of desolation is mentioned by the prophet Daniel. Daniel 9, verse 27, Daniel 11, verse 31, and Daniel 12 and verse 11. So Jesus believed that Daniel was a prophet who wrote the book in his name and not some second century imposter. Also, Christ repeatedly referred to himself in the book of Daniel, which is the only place where you will find it, as the Son of Man, which is taken from the book of Daniel. You can't find that expression anywhere else. Where is it in the book of Daniel? He always, and particularly in the book Matthew's account and some in Luke's account, always when they ask, who are you? I'm the Son of Man. The Son of Man here, the Son of Man this, and the Son of Man that. You notice he didn't say, I'm the Son of God in front of the Pharisees at that point. Why not? Well, we know the one when he finally did, they're picking up the stones. And when he said before Abraham was, I am. Now, he couldn't do that throughout all of his ministry. He was being wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove. But it is in Daniel chapter 7 where the Son of Man comes to the Ancient of Days. And the Ancient of Days is the Father, and the Son of Man, Jesus said, was him. He was the one who the Ancient of Days will give the eternal kingdom to. And you'll find that in Daniel chapter 7 and verses 9 through 14. And Jesus used that, which tells us what? There was no question in Jesus' mind about the book of Daniel or Daniel himself. And these are the first and the best evidences of the authenticity of this particular book, which has come under a lot of fire because they thought a lot of things there that they were unbelievable, those four kingdoms and everything. And we'll get into that as we go along. Let me give you a few others, and then we'll get into the first chapter of the book of Daniel. One other thing here before I do, I'm going to read one other quote about this, about Christ being, how important it is that Christ is the one who really puts the best evidence and proof on the authenticity of Daniel. Now, these two issues are inextricably involved with each other. If Daniel is authentic prophecy and its recorded visions are accurate descriptions of the future given by God himself, then Christ's view of it and of himself are true. But if the book is a fraud, then Christ was mistaken concerning it, and much of the basis for our faith in his integrity and authority must come under severe questioning. Right? I agree with that. Well, obviously, what he is showing here, the authority that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, said this book, and by quoting there about the abomination of desolation. Now, according to the liberals who would disregard Matthew 24, verse 15, if that's the case, yeah, then you would have to begin to question. Why wouldn't Christ know? Well, it makes common sense. A very good comment that was made about that. Let's move on to some other evidences that are quite clear. Turn over here to Ezekiel chapter 14. Ezekiel 14. In Ezekiel, this is one that is very difficult. They just can't reason around. You know how they get around this one? They don't get around it, but they actually have the audacity to say that Daniel, by the way, which is a common name at that era of time, well, we found that name in an Ugaritic tablet worshiping of a pagan god. It was just a name that was borrowed. It wasn't really Daniel, because Daniel had to have been written in the second century. Well, I guess Ezekiel must have lied then. But Ezekiel 14, and in verse 14, though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would deliver only themselves by their righteousness, says the Lord God. And then you see it repeated down in verse 20 again. Now, Ezekiel wrote 15 years after Daniel went into captivity. And so he knew Daniel. And, of course, he was at a different area within the confines of Babylon itself. But he knew of Daniel very, very well, and wrote of him and put him up there with Noah and Job. And, again, when did Ezekiel write Ezekiel? In the 6th century B.C. And he's writing about somebody he knows. And it was Daniel. A couple other things, and then we'll move along. The Septuagint. The Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which took place in the 3rd century B.C. in Alexandria, Egypt. And guess what? The book of Daniel was in it. Now, according to the liberals, it hadn't been written yet. Daniel wrote it in 165, not in the 3rd century. But look what you have. I have a copy of the Septuagint at home. Guess what? The book of Daniel is right there, as it should be. Well, how do you get around that? I don't see. How did a 2nd century imposter get it into the Septuagint, which was translated in the 3rd century B.C.? Another one, some of you have copies of Josephus. In his book Against Appian, and I'll just give you and make it page 776 in the Whiston translation, Josephus lays out the 22 books of the Old Testament in its three divisions. And that's what it was. It corresponded with the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. And guess what's in those 22 books? Daniel, that's right. And what's interesting about what he says there on page 776 in his book Against Appian, which is even more important, is that all of those 22 books were written and canonized by the end of the life of Persian King Artaxerxes, 430 B.C. Very interesting. By the end of the reign of Artaxerxes, the son of Xerxes, all 22 books, as they were arranged in the Jewish three-department order, was completed by that time. Again, certainly Daniel was not written by an unknown author in 165 B.C. Why did they pick that date, by the way? The Abomination of Desolation. That took place, which was described, and you'll find that the first fulfillment of it was in Daniel 11:31. That's why Porphyry in the 3rd century A.D. chose that as the time. Well, he wrote it at the time it was happening, and all he was doing is writing history after it happened. And I'll show you as we go along about the four kingdoms. They disregard the fourth kingdom being the Roman Empire. You might be thinking, then who is the fourth? How do they get four? And why would they disregard the Roman Empire as being the fourth kingdom? Well, I'll tell you when we get there. A couple other things to make sure I've covered some of these notes that I have. And this is just not all in, there's more things than what I have written down here. All right, what about another proof? The Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls, which were discovered in 1947, have both fragments and complete scrolls of the Book of Daniel. And my wife and I have had opportunities to see some of that, and it's really quite interesting to look at those things. You have to, the ones we saw here a couple of years ago, how was that? There was a special light so that you could see it, because you look at it, as they were showing, and you couldn't see any writing until they put a special light on it, and there it is. I don't remember what you call it, but it was quite interesting. And also in the museum or the Dome of the Book or the Book of the Dome, whatever it is in Jerusalem, you'll find there laid out under glass the complete book of Isaiah from the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's just exactly it shows that the Jews have properly preserved through the years the Old Testament, because it goes way back into several hundred years B.C. on that particular copy that we were able to see. Let me pick up here a couple notes I'll read about this. Now, what was discovered by the Dead Sea Scrolls was that they were copied in the 2nd century B.C. by the Essenes, at the area of Qumran by the Dead Sea, from copies that existed before the Maccabean period, and the book of Daniel was already in existence. In other words, what they found were not originals. They are copies. Copies not of the original, but copies of the copies is what the Essenes had. And so it tells us that the book of Daniel existed long before the 2nd century. Indeed, as we know, it did. Now, the language of the book of Daniel is quite interesting. From chapter 2, verse 4, which we will get to today, to chapter 7, verse 28. That is old Aramaic, and not the newer Aramaic of the second century. It is the old Aramaic, as it should be, and covering that area. What does that tell us? Well, it tells us it is absolutely identical with the book of Ezra. Ezra wrote in the 5th century in Old Aramaic, because his is the other book of the Old Testament. Now, we know that Ezra was born and raised in Babylon and then came back to Jerusalem. His letter, or book, I guess you would call it, is part Hebrew, but also a large part of it is Old Aramaic or Chaldee. It agrees with that which is found in the book of Daniel. Now, that could not have happened in the second century, as far as writing the book of Daniel. Here you have corroboration with what you find in the book of Daniel, just in the fact of the language alone. One other thing, the last thing I'll mention as an evidence or a proof. If the book of Daniel was written in the second century, as liberals want to claim, there should be found in the book of Daniel Greek words, just as they are found in 1st and 2nd Maccabees and other writings of the second century. There should be Greek words. Why? Because by 165 BC, a Greek-speaking government had controlled Palestine for over 160 years. If Daniel were written around 165 BC, using a quote again from this book I just quoted from, the absence of Greek terms would be inexplicable, especially political and administrative terms, because, of course, he was involved in government, as you will see as we go through the book of Daniel. Yes, that's a good point. Because in the second century, you know, all languages at various times, they incorporate words from us, just like we have in ours. Many of our words have come from Latin. They've come from Greek. They've come from German. They've come from Spanish. We incorporate because of who we associate with, or where, how we bring in words from other languages. And when the Greeks controlled Palestine for more than 160 years, how would you not have Greek words in there? What do we see instead? You have Old Aramaic and Chaldean, which means, of course, that it was from Babylon and it was in the 6th century, just as it is always said. Well, I wanted to just begin with some of that, because to be aware that this is a book that if you go to the certain schools, they do not want to accept. Of course, they don't want to accept the fact there is a God either. But they don't like the fact that somebody could write a book so incredibly filled with precise prophecies like that. That can't be true. That's impossible. No, it isn't. Okay, let's go to Daniel 1. We'll begin to notice some things here. A lot of times Daniel has been divided into two sections, the first six chapters being more of a history about Daniel and his friends. Although it does, as we will see today in chapter 2, does have prophecy in it as well. The latter six chapters, 7 through 12, are really getting into much more precise prophecy. So sort of like they can break it up. It's not a first and second Daniel. It's just kind of a way that they look at it, that it has two divisions, or they can see it from that perspective as two divisions. It was written by Daniel, not at the beginning of his captivity, because he spent his whole captivity in Babylon. He was taken in, as we will see in verse 1, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, which is between the Tigris and Euphrates River, to the house of his God, and he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. And then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel, and some of the king's descendants, and some of the nobles, This is really quite interesting now as you get into this, because I couldn't help it as I was preparing for this, thinking about some things coming up here in just a couple weeks. I'll be going to camp up in Georgia for our summer camp at Strong Rock. And some of the things I do want to bring out in the Christian Living class there. And I'm going to, I'm thinking anyhow, of using some things from the first chapter of the book of Daniel. Because look at what we have, verse 4. Young man in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge, and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. These four young men, as you'll read about, Daniel and his three friends here, were no older than our counselors at camp. They were basically somewhere between 18 and 22 years of age. They came from the royal family of Zedekiah, who was the last king of Israel, or Judah, I should say, and, of course, the descendants of David. They were well-educated young individuals. There were more than just them, but these four really stood out because of their leadership, their conviction and to serve and obey God, and yet also you see their... When it came down to it, I mean, they were very loyal to the king until, remember what does it say there in Acts 5:29, that we are to obey God rather than man. And they followed that without even knowing it would later be written to a T. And that's exactly what they would do. And they were loyal to the king and stood behind him in everything until those episodes came up. And the fiery furnace, we'll get to that in the next Bible study. But it's interesting here how Daniel, as just a young man, barely a college graduate by today's standards, and how God will use him. And, of course, he uses him throughout all of his life in Babylon. He never returned to Jerusalem. And he, and I assume also his three friends, because they all died in Babylon. And the 70 years of Jeremiah, you know, that's the land will rest for 70 years, Jeremiah 25. Well, they were there more than 70 years. And, of course, he fasted, and we'll see that later in Daniel chapter 9, wanting to know about the 70 years, because the time's up. And he fasted, what was it, 21 days, I believe it was, and to inquire of God, and God answered him, but it wasn't the answer he was expecting. He got what we commonly call the 70 weeks prophecy instead. The coming of the Messiah is more important than returning to Jerusalem. And well, anyhow, that's getting ahead of myself. Let's come back here. So Daniel wrote and put it all together. By the way, he probably had some of this written down of the total book of Daniel as going through his life. For example, in chapter 5, we have the end of his time when Belshazzar and the Babylonian Empire falls in 539. It's not at the end of the book. It's in chapter 5. You got seven more chapters after that. So some things are not just in chronological order here. But the further things we're going to go through here today are, let's move along so I can hopefully get done here. Verse 5, and the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. Now, from among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And to them the king and the chief of the eunuchs gave names, changed their names. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now, how was he being defiled? Was it unclean foods? He wouldn't drink the wine either. One commentary mentioned that it may have been offered things that had previously been offered to their gods, and that type of thing might have entered into it. And it may be unclean things as well. It may be all of the above. We just don't have it precisely spelled out here. Now, God had brought Daniel into favor and good will of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, "I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? And then you would endanger my head before the king." So Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink." I think it says pulse, P-U-L-S-E, in the Authorized King James, but most likely here it's vegetables. Well, then let our, again, you see, for young men like this, they're using wisdom, are they not? And remember, that's what it said back there in verse 4, gifted in all wisdom. Well, that's a pretty wise way to speak to the assistant, or whatever his title was, to the head eunuch here. Because, you know, there's a little pressure on, look, fellas, if I go along with what you want, it's going to be my head. And it's not going to be my head, is what he's saying. And so Daniel is very wise in the way he's talking to him. Just, can you give us 10 days and a vegetarian diet? In fact, probably a lot of people today, that's what they'd want, you know, all vegetables. Anyhow, so they went along, in verse 13, "Then let our countenance be examined before you, and the countenance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies, and as you see fit, so deal with your servants." So he consented with them in this matter and tested them in 10 days. And of course, I'll read, before I read the results, which you already know, they're going to come out better than those who are eating the king's food. That makes you stop and think and wonder here, what was in that king's food? Anyhow, if they're going to come out looking better because they were on an all-vegetable diet, low-carb, all those type of things, I don't think that the king's diet was based upon a great deal of knowledge of nutrition. Verse 15, "And at the end of 10 days, their countenance appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Thus the steward took away their portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink, and gave them vegetables. And as for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams." And of course he would later, and this would come up at the end of the 3 years. But these were very educated young men. They would have been the top educated of our day and age, too. I mean, if you want to, as far as they could be taught and learn, and they were quick to learn, they understood. They also were very humble individuals. We see this because of their obedience, willingness to obey, and willingness to trust in faith. In verse 18, "Now at the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king interviewed them, and among them none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. Therefore they served before the king." So there were others brought in, not just those four. These four stood out. And it really shows, yes, by the fact that God was the chief part of their education. The rest of their education really took them a long ways. I mean, because God was involved with them. Or they involved themselves with God in serving him. Verse 20, "And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm. And thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus." Now, I'll just a note there, because in Daniel 10, verse 1, it talks about the third year of King Cyrus. So, I'm not just quite sure, it's a minor point, because he actually did continue even past the first year of King Cyrus. The first year of Cyrus, by the way, was when Cyrus had been in existence before that time, but it was Cyrus who would give the permission for the captives to come back around 536. One of the interesting things about it was that Isaiah in chapter 44 and 45 of Isaiah talks about Cyrus prophesying of him 120 years before he was born. That prophecy was taken to Cyrus later, and he was quite impressed by that, and certainly that was one of the reasons why that he gave the Jews the permission to go back to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. Chapter 2, we get into the first prophecy in just a little bit here, coming from a dream. Now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. He had multiple dreams, apparently. What we will see here is more of a summary of everything rather than an explanation of the whole thing, because it was apparently more than once. Then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans, to tell the king his dreams. And so they came and stood before the king. The king said to them, "I have had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream." Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic. Right here, verse 4 is where Aramaic begins in this book. Hebrew stopped at verse 3. Aramaic now begins in verse 4, where it says Aramaic. "And king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation." You tell us what it was, and we can come up with the interpretation. "But the king answered, and he said to the Chaldeans, 'My decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made an ash heap.'" People were pretty bloody, weren't they? It's hard to imagine how it's like on the fiery furnace later. You know, burn the guys up, pouring more oil in. They're expendable. I don't know. Maybe a man's always been that way. Maybe it's that way today. It's hard for us, I think, to imagine that. But, you know, people have no regard to life, or that people are going to die. And not just die, but cut them up in pieces and feed them to the dogs, I guess. Verse 6, "Moreover, if you tell the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation." Well, they answered again and said, "Let the king tell his servant the dream, and we will give you its interpretation." The king answered and said, "I know for certain that you would gain time, because you see that my decision is firm." Now, this indicates there must be some kind of a competition, a political competition between the priests and the king going on. And it's like he has got a war here with them. Because, humanly speaking, this is a very unreasonable thing to ask. "If you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decision or decree for you. For you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time has changed." Excuse me. "Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation." The Chaldeans answered the king and said, "There is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such a things of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. It's a difficult thing that the king requires, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, and whose dwelling is not with flesh." Well, interesting, some of the things that are being said here. "For this reason, the king was angry and very furious, and gave a command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. Now I have reason to get rid of all of you guys, because I know that you're probably going to try to get rid of me, and have been all along. So the decree went out, and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them, kill some of these Jewish fellows too. Then the counsel and wisdom, because Daniel was wise, answered Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. And he answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree from the king so urgent? And Arioch made the decision known to Daniel. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the interpretation. And then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to Hananiah and Mishael and to Azariah his companions, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. That was wise right there. We should always take it to God first. Take it to God first. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven, and Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his, and he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. We give credit where the credit is due, is what he is doing there and using our language. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. And I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might. You have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's demand. Well, this is miraculous. There's no other way to explain this, what takes place. Therefore, Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation. And so Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said thus to him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation. And the king answered, and he said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? The answer, of course, is yes, because God gave it to him. Now think in a little bit bigger terms. The southern kingdom of Judah has gone into captivity and isn't going into captivity because it still was yet to have another invasion. The northern kingdom of Israel has long since been gone. And here we have this young Jewish fellows, almost boys, they're just very young men, and who are very faithful to serve God, who trust and look to God and turn to him, and God is using them to be able to come to the greatest kingdom on the earth at that time and to give these prophecies that will lead all the way down to the coming when the kingdom of God will be set up on the earth. And that's what this dream is, the beginning of it. And as you go through the book of Daniel, each vision and dream afterwards adds more information to this one that we start with right here. It is progressive. Then you can go to the book of Revelation, because Jesus Christ is giving. It is Jesus Christ who's giving this. He is the Word, the Logos, the spokesman. It is not the Father that is appearing and giving this to Daniel in these dreams. It is Jesus Christ who is the one who is giving that to Daniel and telling him of these things. Guess who it was that gave it to John in the book of Revelation? Chapters 13 and 14 and 17 and 18. All talking about what? It's more about what you read right here of the, particularly the fourth kingdom. And I'm going to have some things to say about that fourth kingdom in just a moment here, and I'm going to rush along. Let me go ahead here. Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said that the, in verses 27, that the secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these, king. As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. But as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but for our sakes who make known the interpretation to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your heart. It's not that I, because of any wisdom on my part, and he was a wise man. No, it was for a much, much bigger reason and purpose, and of course to save him and his friends' lives too. Verse 31, you, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. It was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs were of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. And then the iron and the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found, and the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Verse 35 there, where it talks about the stone that was cut out without hands, or verse 34, the stone was cut out without hands. Those who tried to say that the book was written in the second century and that all of the prophecies were fulfilled by the time it was written in the second century, not as prophecy but as history, have not been able to explain where is the stone that was cut out without hands. It certainly had not appeared at that point in time. Let me just, we get into the four, well, I'll read a little bit further, and then I want to add one last comment here from a Bible handbook I have. Now, in verse 36, this is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. And of course, each one after that is lesser than the first one. But after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, and then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. And whereas you saw the feet and toes partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw, and the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. And as you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. Now, I'd like to share a little bit here from Halley's Bible Handbook on a good comment about this, because I mentioned to you earlier that the people who take the liberal perspective, they say that the Fourth Kingdom was not Rome. Now, why would they take that position? Well, because at the time of the second century, 165 B.C., the Roman Empire had not risen yet. And it began officially, you might say, as is historically made official, with Julius Caesar in 63 B.C., not 165. It was rising in the West, but had not come yet to the East. The comment here I'd like to read from Halley. Critics who assign a Maccabean date to the book of Daniel, in order to explain it as referring to past events instead of being a prediction of the future, find it necessary to place all four empires prior to the date of composition. coming back here, because it isn't named in the book of Daniel. Do you know that? The Roman Empire, the others are named. Babylon, Greece, Medo-Persians, but you do not have the fourth kingdom named in the book of Daniel. Let me get back here. I lost my spot. and so call the Persian Empire. Okay, wait a minute. Let me back up here. Well, I'll start over. Critics who assign a Maccabean date to the book of Daniel in order to explain it as referring to past events instead of being a prediction of the future find it necessary to place all four empires prior to the date of the composition and so call the Persian Empire two empires, the Median Empire and the Persian Empire, in order to make the Greek Empire the fourth kingdom. But as a matter of fact, there was not a Median Empire and a Persian Empire following the fall of Babylon. To make it appear so is only an effort to distort the facts of history to substantiate a theory. Medes and Persians constituted one empire under the rule of Persian kings. Darius the Mede, this is chapter 5, of course, of Daniel. Darius the Mede was only a sub-king, ruling for a little while under Cyrus the Persian until Cyrus arrived in Babylon. And that is true. So that's how that they take care of the four kingdoms. Midian kingdom had ruled for some time in Asia Minor and had overcome, let's see, the three, in fact it mentions here in the 11th chapter, the three ribs, I believe it is, that they conquered. I lost my spot as far as exactly which chapter where I've seen that. It's either chapter 3 or chapter 8. I have to look it up for the next Bible study. They conquered Egypt one time. They did not conquer Israel or Judah. They did conquer the Lydians, L-Y-D-I-A-N. They then became, in conjunction and rulership with the Persians, when the Persians rose to power. And they were not a separate kingdom after, under Cyrus, the Persians had conquered the Babylonian kingdom. Let me finish now and come back. Now, the reason I want you to know that is because that's come up in the church. And I've had this not too long ago come up, not here, but in another aspect or part of the church, of individuals saying, well, it doesn't say the Roman Empire in the book of Daniel. That's right, it doesn't. And it goes back to this old argument that I don't know if the individuals realize it or not, but it's the old argument that the liberals have used that Daniel is simply history. And so you cannot then, since the Roman Empire, if it was written in the second century, the Roman Empire hadn't risen yet. So it can't be the Roman Empire. But as you're going to see, it's very clearly the Roman Empire without using the name Rome as we go along through this study. Let me finish this chapter and we'll close out here. Verse 44, And in the days of these kings, the King of Heaven, the God of Heaven, will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. And, of course, they're bringing it right down to the time of Christ's return. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what shall come to pass after this. And the dream is certain and its interpretation is sure. Again, if it was written in the second century and it's just simply history fulfilled here, where is the stone cut out without hands? Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. The king answered Daniel and said, truly, your God is the God of gods and the Lord of lords, Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret. And then the king promoted Daniel, gave him many great gifts. He made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Also Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king. Very interesting here how God worked these things out. I'll give you something to think about between now and the next Bible study. After King Nebuchadnezzar bowed down and made this admission, why would he have set up a statue for himself in chapter 3? And if you don't bow down to it, you go into the fiery furnace. Okay? See if you know what the answer is. Think about it for the next Bible study. We'll stop there and have a final song and prayer.